with a compelling perspective on global politics. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, so we're in the second hour of this live broadcast. Thank you guys for joining us. We're going to be joined imminently by TNT's political editor, Basil Valentine, who's going to come in on the line in just a few minutes. And a big thank you, of course, to Arno Devole, author of Foreign Entanglements. The new book is out. I dropped a link to Amazon in the chat room there, you guys. So you definitely want to get your orders in. You can get it on Kindle. I think the consignment that they had of the physical book, Amazon's already sold out. But I think the publisher is going to be delivering new copies this week. So they'll get those moving. So yeah, get your orders in because yeah, it looks like a lot of people are interested in this book. And as we were saying with Arno, I think it's because of the timing of the book and this whole Burisma terrorism slush fund story that sort of emerged in the last week. Very serendipitous with the release of Arno's book. So, I mean, I managed to read this early. He asked me to write a review. So the publishers gave me privy to early access. I wrote a review. Part of that's on the back of the cover of this book. You'll see short review from myself and also Cynthia McKinney, former U.S. Congresswoman, and Dan Kovalik, who is actually Dan Kovalik wrote the first Russia book, the sort of Russiagate book. He's a human rights lawyer, a former law lecturer at Pittsburgh University. And yeah, Dan's also written a short review on this as well. So, I mean, there's some pretty good people have endorsed this book. And I think more people are going to endorse it in the coming weeks and months because the receipts are in here. It's just one of those things. It's like when you're holding this book, you know, you've got basically all the receipts to Biden corruption and all the corruption from sort of the Democratic donor class in Ukraine, plus just generally the U.S. establishment's external management. So they all talk about Ukrainian sovereignty. You hear this. You just heard it in one of the hearings. I think it was a Senate hearing or whatever. And they're talking about, we need to give the Ukrainians, they asked point blank, can Ukraine win? They said, we believe in the sovereignty of Ukraine. They keep saying this in Washington. We believe in the sovereignty. Ukraine is a sovereign country. Listen, newsflash, Ukraine has not been a sovereign country for a very long time, at least since 2014. It's the most unsovereign country probably in the world at this particular moment in time. Completely funded, completely subsidized, micromanaged externally by Washington, by London, and by NATO. So there's no sovereignty. They don't have elections. They've outlawed the oldest Orthodox church in the country. There's no press. There's no free press. There's no opposition parties. There's nothing democratic nor sovereign about Ukraine as it stands. Now they're conscripting basically any male with a pulse between the age of, I don't know, like 20 and 60. There's grandfathers being dragged out and thrown in trenches with like used uniforms. In fact, I saw stories of uniforms being issued with bullet holes in them. Okay, so I don't need to say any more. It's a complete fiasco in Ukraine. So not much sovereignty going on there, and it just plays such a central role in the foreign policy and the story of Washington, of Donald Trump as well, the persecution of Trump and all of his associates. A lot of this tracks back to Ukraine and covering up the corruption in Ukraine. That's what first impeachment hearings against Trump was. It was to basically bury all of the Biden corruption and pave the way for Joe's run for president. That's why that impeachment process was started to begin with. There was no crime by Donald Trump. Anyway, let's bring on to the program right now a political editor for TNT Radio, Basil Valentine's joining us on the line right now. Basil, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Patrick. Good to be with you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
So what do you make right now of the international scene? Basil, I know you've been busy following all the top headlines, both domestically and internationally. What do we need to know right now?
Well, we're all sitting here really with bated breath waiting to find out what Iran is going to do in retaliation for the attack on their embassy in Syria. And, the Russian consulate has now put out a warning saying to its citizens not to travel to the Middle East. The German airline Lufthansa has suspended flights to various destinations in the region. The United States has restricted its employees' travel in Israel, outside the Greater Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Beersheba area in case of attack. Matthew Miller said today, "We conduct ongoing assessments all the time about the situation on the ground. I'm not going to speak to the specific assessments that led us to restrict our employees' and family members' personal travel. But clearly, we are monitoring the threat environment in the Middle East and specifically in Israel." This after the Iranian foreign minister has been shuttling around from Turkey to the Arab Emirates, Qatar, talking to his counterparts. And I suppose assessing what the international support would be for various options that may be on the table. Our own Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, has spoken to him, the Amir Abdullahian, and said that a response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Abdullahian said, would be legitimate. Cameron, on the other hand, has asked Iran to de-escalate, and Iran must not draw the Middle East into a wider conflict. Well, David, shouldn't you be telling that to the Israelis?
No, there's total gaslighting going on in this. If you listen to the news releases on this, when you hear Iranian attacks, Israel's bracing for Iranian attacks, America's concerned about Iranian attacks. They're not Iranian attacks. When you hear anybody say this in any news broadcast, that is gaslighting. They're reading off a script. It is Iranian. It would be Iranian retaliation for an Israeli unprovoked attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus by Israel. So Iran reserves the right, and under international law, can retaliate, because that is that not an act of war, Basil, to attack and blow up somebody's embassy? What do you think?
Yeah, the embassy is theoretically the country of Iran. That's the way diplomacy works with international missions, is that if it's a freehold building, then the soil on which the freehold is held by a foreign country is that country. So there's a postage stamp size part of 150 different countries in London, for example, although the American footprint down in Vauxhall is much bigger than a postage stamp. But that's supposed to be the case. There does seem to be one way out, which is if the United Nations Security Council condemn the attack. Amir Abdullahian said that if the UN fails to condemn the attack, then a legitimate defense with the aim of punishing the aggressor is a necessity and is legitimate. So if the Security Council do condemn the attack, then perhaps the necessity of retaliation would be reduced. But, the Iranians have got their own domestic population to think about, who will be demanding some kind of retaliation. And what's more, of course, if the Israelis can do this once and get away with it effectively because of collective international pressure on the Iranians to de-escalate, then they will do so again.
I agree with you on the UN Security Council point, Basil. Theoretically, that would reduce the tension. I think that would be a positive thing. Isn't that what the UN Security Council exists for, is for things like this? Shouldn't they pass a resolution? Shouldn't everybody agree? Because don't all of these countries have sovereign territory and embassies and diplomatic facilities around the world? And if they're green-lighting Israel to attack and blow up people's embassies unprovoked, aren't they opening the door for future chaos at their door in some time in the future, Basil?
Well, I think the entire United Nations Security Council would almost certainly condemn it, with the exception, of course, of Britain and the United States. Now, I could see us abstaining, possibly, but it might boil down to, will the United States use its veto? According to the State Department, Tony Blinken has spoken to the Turkish, Chinese and Saudi Arabian foreign ministers in the last 24 hours to make clear that escalation in the Middle East is not in anyone's interest.
I always thought when I saw this attack, I don't know if you agree or not, Basil, but when I saw Israel hit the Iranian embassy in Damascus, I thought, why are they doing this other than to try to provoke Iran to retaliate, to hit back, which would then automatically draw the United States into a potential direct confrontation with Iran? And this is exactly what the Biden administration are saying now. They're doing all they can to prepare, and what they would do to retaliate against an Iranian strike, an Iranian attack. You see how this has all been conveniently kind of arranged at the moment to create a narrative, Basil, and that's that somehow Iran is hell-bent on now on attacking Israel and the U.S. And now you've got Marco Rubio and all the rest of them getting their World War III boots on.
The White House has told Iran that it was not involved directly. We communicated to Iran that the U.S. had no involvement in the strike that happened in Damascus, and we have warned Iran not to use this attack as a pretext to escalate further in the region or to attack U.S. facilities or personnel, according to Karine Jean-Pierre. But why do they not make any reference to who did carry out the attack? It's as if Israel doesn't exist in these statements from the White House and from the State Department spokespeople, doesn't it?
So here's what Joe Biden says, Basil. He says, Biden vows ironclad U.S. commitment to Israel amid fears of Iran attack. Again, no mention in this beginning of this article that it is Israel itself that has attacked and blown up an Iranian embassy. It just doesn't even exist in sort of headlines on this. So I see a kind of an operation here in the media, and it's almost like this is eerily familiar to the kind of WMD deception that we saw in the run-up to the Iraq war, where the press seemed to be totally on board with war escalation, and we're just misreporting and trying to willfully deceive the public on all this. So the U.S. president and allied officials fear significant strike within days in retaliation for the Israeli bombing a consular building in Damascus. I mean, also, Basil, my false flag alarm is going off full blare right now. I mean, it's like if a bomb went off of some description somewhere in the world, who are they going to blame? Immediately, the blame will go to fill in the blank. What do you think?
That's always a danger, although the Iranians haven't been framed in that way as much as, let's say, sort of other nefarious groups, you know. There's always the chance of it. But talking in about war escalation, as we speak, there is a demand victory Rafah now rally taking place in Jerusalem. Several hundred people demanding a ground offensive in the southern Gaza Strip right now, which they say will result in a complete victory. That's the sort of the pro-war movement flexing its muscles in Israel. Meanwhile, you know, it's worth remembering that something like 70 people have been killed in the last 36 hours in Rafah as a result of airstrikes. It's almost as if this passes off now completely without incident. That's why I feel constrained to mention it. Imagine for just a moment that 70 Israelis had been killed over the last 72 hours in Israel as a result of strikes by Hamas. You know, the wailing would be audible all the way from Tel Aviv to Washington, but, you know, because it's Palestinians dying, barely a ripple, Patrick, if that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm a little bit concerned. I know you are as well. A lot of people seeing very disturbing signs here, very worrying signs that something is afoot, that something is being planned, some sort of escalation. And I think unfortunately, the wheels are already in motion on this. I'm hoping that there's just somebody sane in Washington, especially that will step forward and maybe hit the brakes, because this has happened before. The United States has been on a path of escalation, particularly with Iran. This happened under the Trump administration. We found out later, after the fact, Basil, that we came very close to kind of launching a war against Iran. And it was the Donald Trump administration that hit the brakes. The war hawks, Lindsey Graham and everybody else, was basically on board with some sort of strike against Iran at the time during the Trump administration, and that stopped. That's not to say Donald Trump unfortunately followed up with what I thought was a terrible move in assassinating Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Melendez in January of 2020. But that's an unfortunate footnote of history there. So where does that leave us right now with, I think UNICEF aid workers have been killed in Gaza. So interesting series of events following the murder of the aid workers from the World Central Kitchen just last week, in fact, that spurred a huge wave of international indignation and outrage. Basil, what, have you heard anything about this latest UNICEF incident?
Yeah, UNICEF car was hit by gunfire. I don't know if anybody was killed, to be honest. But just to go back, it's making me laugh, but Iranian threats to carry out a missile strike against Israel are unacceptable, the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said, that dreadful word that, you know. Where does someone like Sunak get off, you know? Why has he not immediately come out and condemned the strike on the embassy to begin with? It's so one-sided. It turns out that the awful Annalena Baerbock, the woman masquerading as the German foreign minister, has called her Iranian counterpart Amir Abdullahian to urge maximum restraint.
Iran hasn't threatened. They haven't threatened a missile salvo against anybody, to my knowledge. Is this like they've just conjured up that a threat has somehow automatically been made when it hasn't actually been made by any Iranian officials? They haven't said, we're going to hit you with a missile salvo tomorrow. I've not seen that report. So what are these Western political leaders talking about?
Well, the danger is that, you know, that Iran may use its proxies in southern Lebanon, in Hezbollah, to attack a major target on Israeli soil. And the Americans have said that if that happens, then they may intervene on Israel's behalf. So, you know, that's the danger. It would be much
against Iran. Intervene against Iran. So this is that adds another confusing dimension to all this, Basil, is that if anything is then blamed on Hezbollah, and again, I talked earlier about a false flag potential, some incident could be blamed on Hezbollah. You know how the U.S. and Western media are going to react. They're going to say Iran, 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 and then we're off to the races at that point. That's a dangerous, I think, point here. The tension needs to be dialed down. By somebody needs to step forward and dial this tension down, like, immediately. But I don't see anybody who's capable or willing to do that at the moment.
Well, you know, other than just this endless mantra of urging the Iranians to act with restraint, why doesn't somebody tell the Israelis to act with restraint? I mean, simultaneously bombing Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. Iran's permanent mission to the UN has, of course, criticized the Security Council for failing to condemn Israel's reprehensible act of aggression. They posted a statement on the X platform saying the imperative for Iran to punish this rogue regime, Israel, might have been obviated had the council condemned it. So with one day of the working week to go, tomorrow, Friday, it's to be hoped that there is at least a motion put before the Security Council, because, you know, otherwise all bets are off, as they say.
No, it's very, very dangerous, very problematic situation that we find ourselves in here. And this is the danger of escalation and no diplomacy, no negotiations, and really running gunboat diplomacy and leaving it up to the hawks. You get these sort of situations. This is like the inevitability, Basil, of the reports when you read the historical accounts of the run-up to the First World War. They all say, well, there was an air of inevitability that this great war was going to happen and had to happen in Europe. And it surely did. And the devastation that was wrought as a result, well, we all know our history with World War I. I can't see that there would be a happy ending to World War III other than a lot of misery and destruction as a result. Totally avoidable, though, as was World War I. But some actors behind the scenes have other ideas on these things. And unfortunately, they're not as reasonable or rational maybe as we are in the way that we're presenting our arguments here. But I do see those parallels, Basil. Your final thoughts before we go to break.
I'm not a student of the First World War. I studied medieval history, so what we've got at the moment is certainly the most dangerous situation of the last 25 years. We can say that, I think, without fear of contradiction. I mean, we've got the potential for World War III breaking out in two separate places simultaneously, with the hawks in NATO talking about boots in the ground as Zelensky's had to pass a new law today, lowering the age of conscription and changing the terms on which people are conscripted. It's now down from 27 to 25. The Ukrainian defense officials are saying they're outnumbered by 7 or 10 to 1 in key areas by the Russians, and are demanding more, you know, cannon fodder, basically, which was, of course, the case in World War One. In some ways, the war in Ukraine and isn't all that different from the First World War, in as much as it consists of serried ranks of artillery bombing and shelling each other, which is precisely what they did in World War One, with a eerie no man's land in between. It's really not that dissimilar, Patrick.
So then that leads us to the final question, Basil. Is World War III on the ballot in the 2024 U.S. election? It's Biden or Trump. Is World War III on the ballot?
Well, the general thinking is that Trump is less likely to go for World War III. David Cameron was sent away with a flea in his ear by Trump and his campaign staff earlier this week. The official statement from Trump's spokesperson after their meeting at Mar-a-Lago was that, amongst other things they talked about, was ending the killing in Ukraine. Well, Trump has said he could end the war within 24 hours. Ending the killing is very different from David Cameron's agenda, which is to continue the killing, to make sure that Ukraine have got sufficient bullets to do their share of the killing. That's David Cameron's stated position. So it was noteworthy, I think, that the language, which is always very carefully selected on these occasions, from Trump's spokesperson, talked about ending the killing. And, you know, in his own way, although obviously a fervent supporter of the Israelis, I think Trump would be, put it this way, more active in seeking to find a solution to the situation in Gaza, because even people like Tim Kaine, Hillary's running mate, and a staunch sort of parrot of the endless mantra about Israel's right to defend himself, he's come out and said that he thinks Netanyahu has played Joe Biden over the last 6 months. And, you know, that's the general consensus, really, that he's taken Biden for a ride. And the president has been far too passive, far too inactive, really, for months now, and allowed the absolutely horrific situation over there to develop.
Basil Valentine, political editor at TNT, really appreciate you joining us this week. Take care.
Thank you, Patrick.
I'm going to take a short break right now with the network. And when we come back, we're going to welcome onto the stage a very special guest, former political consultant, maybe still a political consultant, but best-selling author, Roger Stone, is going to be joining us on the program in just a minute. So you don't want to miss that. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
TNT's Rick Munn.
Surely basic common sense should overrule any need for any report when it comes to this. I mean, is this the only time in history that a report would even be needed or be commissioned and take 4 years to write to stop mutilating children, to stop messing around with their puberty and with their development, to stop indoctrinating them and assisting them to destroy their bodies before even the age of 18 in some cases? Surely that's basic common sense. At no other point in history, certainly that I'm aware of, in the United Kingdom or Ireland, has this been facilitated before. It's only been in the last, decade or so that this has started to become a thing that doctors and teachers and parents and politicians have actually gotten behind and encouraged.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it.
That's a campaign promise.
Tell us the truth. Tell us the truth.
We mandate that the truth be told.
You're hearing it.
TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're in the final segment of the final hour of this broadcast today on Thursday, and I'm very pleased to welcome onto the stage longtime Republican strategist, New York Times bestselling author, and host of The Stone Zone, excellent political program. Roger Stone's joining us on the line right now. Roger, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
Roger, I just want to say it's an absolute honor to speak to you, and I'm glad that you're active in this election cycle. It is the strangest election cycle, Roger, in my lifetime. I don't know if you agree. A lot of people say this doesn't feel like an election. I want to talk about that, what your thoughts are on 2024, and also this lawfare against Donald Trump is kind of spun out of control. Looks like it's backfiring. I want to get your thoughts on all of this. How do you think this is shaping up?
What you said initially is absolutely correct. It's unlike any other presidential election that I have seen. And of course, I've been involved at a junior or senior level in 13 national Republican presidential campaigns. I mean, there's a backlash in the country against the disastrous effects of the Biden administration policies, whether it is gasoline prices, food prices, inflation, the fact that we have an invasion on our southern border, which is causing a fentanyl crisis, a crime crisis, a fiscal crisis, as cities and counties across the country threaten to go broke because a law requires them to pay for social services for illegals, even if they have to cut social services or services on American taxpayers. Meanwhile, the country is on the precipice of World War III. Secretary of State Blinken says that in September that Ukraine will join NATO, which is a violation, of course, of the Budapest Memorandum that we signed with the Russians. It's a violation of the Minsk Accords. We're violating treaties that we signed with the Russians to mount missiles in Ukraine pointed at Russia, which Putin has made clear is a line in the sand for him. So I think there's a very negative reaction in the country. Oddly enough, it's counterintuitive, but Donald Trump's candidacy has been turbocharged by these over-the-top and, I think, extraordinarily transparent efforts to jam him up in criminal indictments when they had to go fabricate crimes They are desperately afraid that he is on his way to returning to the White House, and he poses an existential threat to the neocon policies that are slowly but surely destroying the country.
And the lawfare is pretty shocking, Roger, even by like South Latin American dictatorial banana republic standards. This is like totally out of control to have this many cases stacked up and timed to coincide with the primaries. There are attempts to keep Donald Trump off the ballot in some states because he was accused of things. You were on the front line of this lawfare, and I'm going to say the case against you is one of the gravest miscarriages of justice that I ever saw up to that date, to fabricate, you know, some story about you being a go-between with the Russians and WikiLeaks, a ridiculous case. But yet they managed to put together a jury and a judge to push that one through. Totally ridiculous on its face, but this is all connected, isn't it, Roger? You're actually the sort of catalyst, that story that they tried to place you in, that was one of the linchpins for the whole Russiagate myth. You actually wrote a best-selling book on this, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. There was no evidence that there ever was an online hack of the Democratic National Committee by Russian intelligence or anybody else for that matter. They admitted, interestingly enough, when BuzzFeed, now out of business, a liberal rag, sued to get Robert Mueller's, the special counsel's, final long hidden, long redacted final report unsealed, he himself admitted that he had found no evidence of Russian collusion, WikiLeaks collaboration, or any other crime on my part. So then what did I lie to Congress about? What would have been my motive to lie? There was no underlying crime to lie about. No, I was prosecuted because after Mueller and his associates spent $30 million with unlimited legal authority, with unlimited manpower, with an unlimited budget, couldn't find any evidence of Russian collusion on the part of Donald Trump or his campaign, so they sought to fabricate it. They pressured me to testify falsely against the president regarding some 29 phone conversations we'd had in 2016, which I refused to do. I'd already passed polygraph tests, multiple, proving that all of that was a lie. Not admissible in court, but the FBI uses them regularly. So it is, I guess I was an early test case, but now this is an absurdity. So we're going to prosecute Donald Trump in Florida, but we presented the evidence to charge him to a grand jury in D.C., but we're prosecuting him in Florida for retaining certain classified and top secret documents, which the president argues under the Presidential Records Act he was entitled to do. But we know for a certainty that as vice president and a U.S. senator, Joe Biden illegally and willfully retained top secret and classified documents, but he's not being prosecuted. Therein is one of the great examples of the two-tiered justice system. Now we're about to go to trial in New York for a case that the federal prosecutors passed on because they didn't think it had merit. At worst, this is a business records civil case, if it's that, but we bumped it up to be a criminal trial in which the two main accusers of Donald Trump have both testified and written that he didn't make payments to buy anyone's silence. They now have changed their stories. The judge in this case is given a contribution to Joe Biden's reelection, which should eliminate him as the judge immediately. And now we've learned that his daughter, who's an adult, as a Democratic political operative, she's raised $93 million for her Democrat clients using this trial as the hook for her fundraising. An egregious conflict of interest. There's no chance that judge, of course, will recuse himself. That's, by the way, would be a certainly strong grounds for appeal. But see, they don't care about the ultimate result. The idea is just to get a conviction, some conviction, any conviction of Donald Trump before the election, because as the president says, this is all election interference.
No, this is beyond conflicts of interest, Roger. We're at the level of political racketeering. If you look at how well organized this is, and how the overlaps of the political establishment with the judiciary, the weaponization of the Department of Justice, of Attorney Generals, Letitia James herself in New York is on record saying she's going to get Donald Trump. And yet she's allowed to run point on one of these high profile cases. I mean, this would have, look back in your experience, Roger, you've seen the decades. And would this, at what point in history in the timeline has this become allowable? Because this would have been thrown out, or no one would touch it just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. When did it all change?
I think this weaponization is you're right. It is fairly new. Look, when there was a media monopoly, when outlets like TNT radio didn't exist, when there was no internet, it was very easy to bring down Richard Nixon, whose crimes now look like small potatoes compared to the abuse of power by the Obama administration. But there was no place Nixon could go to mount a defense. We had three networks. They were against him. We had no national newspapers. The Washington Post and New York Times were not yet national newspapers. The news magazines like Time and Newsweek were enormously powerful and influential, but there was no place he could go to mount a defense. Yet you look at the alleged crimes, and they really seem rather minor. Here, in the case of the Russian collusion hoax, for example, this is an abuse of power in which the full authority of the United States government and the extraordinary capability of our intelligence agencies is used, utilizing what they know is completely fabricated evidence to mount an illegal coup to take down a duly elected president. It's used to justify FISA warrants to spy on Donald Trump's associates. It's used to appoint as a justification to appoint a special counsel based on what evidence? Not the hack of the Democratic National Committee, because the forensic evidence would indicate that actually never happened, nor the Steele dossier, this falsified report that claims that Donald Trump cavorted with prostitutes in Moscow when he was a private citizen. The progenitors of the Russian collusion hoax know that all of that is nonsense, but they use it anyway to try to take down Donald Trump.
The one of the big tragedies, and one of the, maybe this was intended, Roger, but the whole Russia collusion hoax, which you outlined incredibly well in your best-selling book, The Myth of Russian Collusion, New York Times bestseller. Roger, it helped to formulate foreign policy. That's the frightening part, is it provided that sort of bed of American belief. At least half the country believed that the Russians installed Donald Trump into the White House by nefarious means in 2016. That might sound like a crazy conspiracy theory, but I'm faced with people on a daily basis that still believe that happened, Roger, despite the fact you and everyone else has debunked it. And it's affecting our foreign policy, and it's put us in this position, as you said initially, where we're facing a potential third world war. How did we get here?
Look, I think you're absolutely right. Here's the thing about the left. It doesn't matter how debunked, disproved, or discredited any of their BS is. If you just wait a few days, they'll come back and recycle it all back through again. So I'll give you an example. Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager, shared polling information with a Russian intelligence asset who in turn most likely shared it with Putin. Well, first of all, the Trump campaign had no proprietary polling information. They hadn't polled yet. And the man in question, Konstantin Kalemnik, I think is Matt Taibbi, the independent journalist, certainly no conservative or Republican, is proved was actually a U.S. intelligence asset. So that whole narrative is entirely false. Or the idea that I was a cutout between WikiLeaks, the Russians, and the Trump campaign. No evidence of that ever produced. In fact, only because BuzzFeed sued the Justice Department on Election Day, November 3rd, 2020, at midnight. Strange time for a press release, wouldn't you say? They're forced to release the last remaining unredacted version of Robert Mueller's final report, in which he admits that he found no evidence of Russian collusion, WikiLeaks collaboration, or any other crime on my part. But as Ray Donovan, who was the Secretary of Labor under Ronald Reagan, who was vilified in a phony witch hunt corruption scandal, later exonerated, where do you go to get your good name back? The distortion and smear is the name of the game.
And, you know, a lot of people will be accusing the current president, Joe Biden, of, you know, executing U.S. foreign policy in order to cover up possibly his own past involvement or indiscretions as they relate to Ukraine, his son Hunter Biden, their business dealings internationally, and that he could possibly be blackmailed, perhaps, for whatever they're doing overseas over those years. I mean, there's a lot of receipts that point in this direction, especially right now with some of the things that have come out into the public domain recently. Roger, is it possible that you could have a U.S. president who's compromised at a level? And this is like a real compromised situation, not the mythical one that they said Donald Trump was being blackmailed by the Russians. You actually have the potential here for, let's say, the Zelensky government to be leaning on the Biden administration because of tapes or other evidence of Biden corruption in Ukraine. Is this a possibility?
I think it is. Based on what we've seen, it's highly likely, or it's no different than Chinese interests giving six figures to the University of Pennsylvania, who turns around and pays it to Joe Biden to be a professor for a class that he never actually teaches. yet another example of this administration being compromised. Yet there are Republicans in the House who don't seem to have the belly for impeachment. I mean, there's far more evidence today that we've already seen that is very real, it's not speculative, to justify articles of impeachment against Joe Biden, far more than we ever had in the two articles of impeachment that were voted against Donald Trump. And as you point out, the second impeachment about Ukraine, where they essentially impeached Trump for a conversation that he has with Zelensky, in which he's trying to root out corruption, is really designed to cover up the fact that it was Joe Biden who basically threatened to withhold federal funds, U.S. funds, from Ukraine unless they fired a prosecutor who was investigating who? Hunter Biden and his business connection with Burisma. So, look, this is for the full use of Alinsky's rules for radicals, okay? Anything they accuse Trump of, anything they accuse Trump's supporters of, is exactly what they themselves are doing. Vice President Kamala Harris has a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, this week, and she says, if Donald Trump is elected, he will use the DOJ, he will weaponize the DOJ against his political opponents. Does this woman have no self-awareness whatsoever?
No, well, we're at that point, Roger, where if a new administration came in, I think a lot of people, admittedly, definitely on the right side of the aisle, but even some on the left would say that there's a deep, deep corruption or politicization of the FBI, of the DOJ, just as two major agencies. You could extend that to other agencies. I'm sure you could probably comment on that. But just on that basis, there would have to be a clean out. Because it's so systemic at this point, we're seeing it manifesting to the point where it's interfering with a general presidential election. I mean, that's a crisis moment for the country. So if Donald Trump was elected and he cleared house and fired everybody, appointed new people and got rid of the corruption right down the ranks, you know that the Democrats and the media would cry fascism at that point. They would say he's weaponized the executive branch or whatever. But how did we get to this point? We got to this point because of politicization of these agencies. Your thoughts?
I mean, look, just yesterday we saw John Brennan saying that, warning us that Donald Trump has already made an agreement with Vladimir Putin that he can have all of Ukraine. This is the same John Brennan who was an admitted communist who approved the visa of four of the hijackers who attacked America on 9/11 when he was the station chief in RIDA. The same John Brennan who at least one FBI counterterrorism expert and one former CIA counterterrorism expert have come forward to say converted to radical Islam, to Wahhabism, when he was the station chief. The same John Brennan who claimed that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation, and who, based on special counsel John Durham's report, was one of the major architects of the false claim that Donald Trump had Russian assistance in his election. So he's right back at it again with the same recycled disinformation. The people who are a threat to democracy, or more specifically, the people who are a threat to our constitutional republic, are the Biden administration and his deep state puppeteers, who will now continue to accuse us of exactly what they are doing. What could be less democratic, or I should say more anti-democratic, than trying to keep Donald Trump off the ballot? What could be more anti-democratic than trying to censor people's speech on social media platforms and on the internet? What could be more anti-democratic than charging your opponents with crimes this close to an election? If you were going to charge Donald Trump with crimes in connection with January 6th, why didn't they do it in 2021? Why are they doing it now? Because they're losing. That's why.
No, it's a pretty obvious case. Unfortunately, we have to deal with this as the train is moving down the track towards November 2024. All this stuff is having to be sorted out along the way. And let's talk about 2024 for the remaining minutes that we have, Roger. What do you see happening? Because it's like I've never seen a Democratic incumbent polling so low with so little support from his own party, let alone moderates and independents, than Joe Biden. Is he going to be replaced? I know you talked earlier in the media about the Michelle Obama possibility. Have you had any updates in your thinking on how they're going to manage this? Because it's not looking good from a polling point of view for
Look,
Biden.
I think the leaders of the Democratic Party, the leaders of the government media cabal, are increasingly aware of the fact that Joe's not reelectable based on his inability to string together a sentence. Yesterday, when asked about his legacy, he seemed to take credit for ending the war in Vietnam. Then he went on to say peacemaker would be his legacy. This is the guy who is on the verge of walking us into World War III in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the same guy who is funding both sides of the conflict in the Middle East. So they know he is not electable based on not only his own inability to perform as a candidate, never mind a president, but also based on the disastrous impact of his policies, gasoline prices, food shortages, epic inflation, the migrant invasion, which is giving us a fentanyl crisis, a crime crisis, a fiscal crisis, as local governments struggle to provide social services for illegals, having to cut social services and other services on U.S. taxpayers. Now you add to that the burgeoning corruption of the Biden crime family, and you only have to reach the inexorable conclusion that Joe is not reelectable. So I still believe that they've cleared the field for him, so he'll garner enough delegates to be nominated. But I think on the eve of their convention, I still believe that he will be pressured, perhaps with the threat of removal under the 25th Amendment by his Democrat colleagues, to announce that, not that he's stepping down, but that he is simply not running again. That means he would retain the authority to pardon himself, his brother, his son, and other members of the Biden crime family before he leaves. And at that point, he could release his delegates. And if the convention worked its way, its will, and selected the most popular Democrat in the country, well, that would be Michelle Obama. I saw Joe Rogan essentially say this yesterday. Thank you very much, Joe. I said that 2 years ago. I still think it's entirely possible. Now, Biden, I think, is determined to stay. Dr. Jill is particularly determined to stay. You saw that angry press conference he did when the special counsel concluded that he had very definitely, willfully, illegally retained documents he was never supposed to have. He said that he was the best qualified person in the country to be president, And who could do what he's done? Indeed, who could? Who could destroy the most robust economy in our country's history? Who could bring us from having no new foreign wars under Donald Trump to the brink of two wars around the globe? Who could give us this kind of spending and thus this kind of rate of inflation? So he's very stubborn. That he does have that one quality. He's been wrong on every major foreign policy issue since he first came to the Senate, but he's extraordinarily stubborn. He sees himself as a Kennedy. He thinks the poll numbers are wrong. You saw how his wife reacted on, I think it was The View the other day, when they said, your husband's behind in this. No, he's not. She said, he's going to win. Well, what do they know that we don't know?
Well, that brings up a question about the election integrity problems that we had in 2020 and in 2022 in my home state of Arizona. Carrie Lake clearly was, I'm going to say it, she was robbed of her gubernatorial seat in that election. Have these issues been resolved, Roger? Just what are your feelings on that? Because this is still a hanging chad for the country.
Yeah, no, they have not been resolved. That's, and that therein lies a giant problem. The Republican National Committee for the last 3 years, which has certainly had the resources, done nothing in terms of challenging in court or going into state legislatures to try to guarantee a fair, free, fair, transparent election. You've had some minor reforms in Wisconsin. I think they did away with drop boxes, but by and large, the same post-COVID-19 induced laws that were in place for the last election are still in place. We're now working against the clock. The voter lists in almost all these states are very dirty. I was in Nevada not long ago, and I was speaking, and a man showed me five ballots. This was before the last election, I guess. And I said, what are those? He says, well, these are five ballots mailed to the place I live. I said, well, who? I don't get it. He said, well, one of them's addressed to me. The other four are addressed to people who once rented my apartment. I said, well, where are they? He said, well, two of them are dead, and the other two moved out of state, and one of them has been gone for 15 years. Gives you a perfect example. That's true. That's true in Florida as well, and many other states. The voter laws, the voter rolls need to be clean. We're not trying to disenfranchise any real person who's eligible to run. That's not what I'm saying. But no, I think the election machinery has not been updated. There's the real possibility of the same kind of fraud that existed in the last election. There is no place in the country where the fraud is more outrageous and more provable than in Arizona. 59% of the polling places in Maricopa County are not operating properly on election day, and they just disproportionately, coincidentally, happen to be the most heavily Republican precincts. Please give me a break.
And lastly, before we go, Roger, I appreciate your time. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you about these issues. Donald Trump's vice presidential pick, he is running away in the polls, at least on the Republican side, but could a strategic VP pick win back some of that middle ground or white suburban women, housewives, those key demographics that you do need to win a national election? Some names have been kicked around. Kirstie Noem, Ben Carson's name has been coming up. Do you have any preference or any thoughts on this before we break?
Well, first of all, there's actually no historical precedent for the vice presidential candidate actually making a positive difference in a presidential campaign. President Richard Nixon once told me, when looking for a vice presidential running mate, don't look for someone who can help you. Just try to find someone who doesn't hurt you. That may be a little cynical, but I think there are several criteria here. First of all, you need someone who the American people can look at and say, yes, that person has the experience, the judgment, the temperament, the capability to be president, if God forbid that should become necessary. Secondarily, you want somebody who's policy views are completely copacetic with Donald Trump on the border, on war and peace issues, on the Second Amendment, on abortion, on every major issue that will come up in this campaign. Then I think you can start looking at the political considerations. You need somebody who is sure-footed, somebody who has enough experience in campaigning. They're not going to make rookie mistakes. The idea of trying to pick somebody who appeals to a specific constituency, well, the candidate who would get us the most black votes is Donald Trump. The candidate who's getting us the most Hispanic votes is Donald Trump. An argument could be made for a woman candidate. The Democrats will have one way or another, in my view. I've been criticized by some, but I like Tulsi Gabbard when it comes to war, abortion, guns, and the border. She's solid. Yeah, she was a Democrat. Ronald Reagan was a Democrat. We need some Democrat votes to win, but there are other very good candidates potentially. I like Devin Nunes, 20 years in the House, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, was a dairy farmer before he went to Congress. Tough as nails, experienced, sure-footed, knows the Russian nonsense inside and out. Upstate New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who's shown enormous courage in criticizing the weaponization of the Department of Justice, filing formal complaints against judges and so on. Just to name three, I'm not endorsing anyone. I'm for whoever Donald Trump is for. But I think above all, we need someone who meets those criteria.
No, thank you very much for that. Great to have your thoughts on that. A lot of people are thinking about that at the moment. Roger Stone, longtime political consultant, best-selling author, host of The Stone Zone. Highly recommended program. Thank you for joining us on TNT this week.
Happy with you.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That is Roger Stone. Fantastic segment. Look, big thank you to everybody. Basil Valentine and Arno Devole, author of Foreign Entanglements. Great book on Biden corruption in Ukraine. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you same time, same place tomorrow. Take care. All the best.